Good evening and welcome to the fourth presentation in this our 13th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague somewhere out there, Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster, Haiwan Wan, back there taking pictures, and our instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Terry Perkins. Our speaker tonight is a native of the hockey-mad city of Montreal, Canada, where he grew up dreaming of being the next Guy Lafleur or Patrick Roy. He attended Tufts University in Boston, where he spent a year abroad in Ecuador, studying Spanish and became interested in Latin American culture. In 1998, he received a Canadian Foreign Government Award for research on the Jewish community in Colombia. He later earned his PhD from Rutgers for research on ethnicity and identity in 20th century Argentina. His interest in Argentina and Buenos Aires developed over a decade ago after hearing an Israeli professor at McGill University in Montreal speak about Jewish immigration to Buenos Aires. He made his first trip there in 1999 and has returned numerous times, including a two-year stint from 2001 to 2003 as an Organization of American States graduate research fellow. This past summer, he took a group of students there as part of Key's Argentina program. One of the highlights of his trip, he says, was catching a Boca Juniors soccer game at the famed La Bombonera Stadium in the heart of Buenos Aires' historic Italian quarter. At WKU, he's participated in six study abroad trips to Latin America, and he's currently assistant director of the Kentucky Institute for International Studies. The focus of the talk tonight will be on the long-standing and rich immigration tradition in the vibrant South American city of Buenos Aires. Please give a warm welcome to John Diskin. John?
Thank you to Brian and everyone, and particularly for reminding me of what I did over the last 15 years of my life, because that was getting a little blurry. Tonight we're going to look at Buenos Aires in the southern part of South America, and in particular immigration and the legacy of immigration in Buenos Aires. And we're going to kind of focus on the period through roughly about World War II, and then jump ahead and look at some of the kind of contemporary legacies of this rich period of mass immigration that took place. I have 1820 to 1930 on the slide, but really the period of mass immigration in Buenos Aires and Argentina was about 1870 to 1914, with some immigration before and some after. Now, when we think of immigration, which is, you know, the movement of people across oceans, across continents, we think of often the United States of America for very good reason. As you can see, the U.S. received more immigrants, European immigrants, during this period of mass immigration than any other country in the world. What we often don't think of is Argentina's number two. And if you look at the statistics, you can see it kind of puts itself ahead of other major countries like Canada, Brazil, and Australia. And who would have even thought that Cuba received that many immigrants? Fidel Castro is the son of Spanish immigrants, or the child of Spanish immigrants. And one of the interesting things that we'll come to see about Argentina is, even though you look at the numbers, you'll be like, well, Argentina pales in comparison to the United States. At a given point in Buenos Aires, there are actually more foreigners in Buenos Aires than there were in any city in the United States, percentage-wise, including New York City. I always like to make sure we know where we are talking about, looking at. So we're going to be kind of talking about European immigration, as we'll come to see, largely from the southern part of Europe, Spain and Italy, but also France, Germany, England, and Eastern Europe over here. And we're looking at these immigrants coming to the city of Buenos Aires, which sits between kind of two rivers meeting, the Parana and Uruguay rivers, coming into the Rio de la Plata. So this is quite a long trek to get from Europe to New York. It is a much shorter distance, relatively speaking, than down to Buenos Aires. If you were to take a flight from London to Buenos Aires today, how long would that take us?
16 hours, 14 minutes.
There you go. And just a few facts and figures about Argentina. You see there are kind of two independence days that I put at the top there. Argentina can never quite get its act fully together, so they like to do things a little bit more complicatedly. The 2 days, one refers to Buenos Aires' independence, if you will, its decision to break away from Spain in 1810. So the 25 de Mayo, or as Argentines or Porteños, those from Buenos Aires, those of the port pronounce it, 25 de Mayo. They do that weird thing with the Y. And July 9th, or El 9 de Julio, 1816, is when the rest of Argentina declared independence, and that's when Argentina officially becomes an independent country, but they celebrate, particularly in Buenos Aires, both days. Territorially, very large country, as I mentioned, those two main rivers, which makes it a little bit different than many other Latin American countries. If you think of the United States, we've got so many rivers running through it, with obviously the Mississippi being the biggest one. Latin America, one of the geographic obstacles to Latin America is it doesn't in many places have these large rivers that kind of dissect or bisect the continents. And as a result, that makes transportation and other things more challenging. Argentina, and particularly the area around Buenos Aires going north, did not suffer from that problem because you had these two rivers, the Paraná and the Uruguay River, coming towards the Rio de la Plata, which is kind of this body of water here spitting out into the Atlantic, where Buenos Aires sits on one side and Montevideo, Uruguay, sits on the other side. Population-wise, you see the numbers there. Buenos Aires, we refer to as BA. Buenos Aires is a city with about 13 million people. That includes basically Capital Federal, which would be like the district of. So Buenos Aires is a federal district that is an entity unto itself in Argentina. It does not belong to any one province. And then just around the official borders of that Capital Federal of the city of Buenos Aires is the province of Buenos Aires, and much of the metro region of what we call Buenos Aires today falls outside that Capital Federal area into the province of Buenos Aires. So in terms of the city itself, you're talking probably roughly about 3 million people, but once you include the metro region, you're looking at about 13 million. And in terms of GDP, it's a country that once was the fifth biggest. It's fallen much more than kind of where it sits now. Per capita income, just under $10,000. Life, that's US dollars, life expectancy. Unemployment rate's a little bit fishy because depending on who you ask, those numbers often get fudged. I think the more important statistic there is that PBPL, which is population below poverty line. And Argentina had a massive economic crisis in 2001, 2002. That was really the equivalent of like a depression, almost like, or not quite, but almost like a 1930s depression. And around 30% of their population sits below the poverty line today. And some people suggest even higher. At the same time, you have large segments of the population that are very wealthy and sophisticated in ways that would be comparable to what we would consider sophisticated in the United States. Inflation is another one of those numbers that has a lot of controversy surrounding it. The government will put the official inflation rate at about 8%. Economists put it at 25%. And today there's even friction when an economist speaks out. The current government is kind of squashing out some of the civil liberties that Argentina's long enjoyed. And they're even occasionally putting an economist under censorship or occasionally in prison for making such claims as 25% inflation, but indeed those are accurate. And the Gini coefficient, which just basically measures the gap between rich and poor in a country, if you will, the United States sits roughly at the same point as Argentina. Countries like Britain, France, and Canada are in the high 20s, low 30s. A country like Brazil, which has a very wide gap between the rich and the poor, sits at around 58. Now, the question would come, why would immigrants from Europe go to a place like Argentina? What is it in Argentina that is attracting those immigrants? And at the same time, what is it in Europe that's pushing those immigrants from places like France, Germany, Spain, Italy, Eastern Europe, even the Middle East, to go abroad and choose a country like Argentina? So there are a number of what you can call push factors. That's what immigration people will call them, and pull factors. The push ones are those factors that are causing people to leave Europe. What is pushing them out of Europe, and then what is attracting them or pulling them to a place like Argentina. So on the push side, it's largely, as you would imagine, economic. This is the same motivations that are causing Italians and Greeks and Chinese and others during this period of mass immigration to move to the United States. They are choosing for the same reasons to go to places like Argentina, and that is the economic situation, particularly in the southern part of Europe, Italy and Spain notably, is not very good in the second half of the 1800s. And as you get closer to kind of the 1870s, 1880s, there's an agricultural, you know, recession, if you will, in southern Europe. And these people are looking for work, they're looking for to better their lives economically. And it's at precisely that time that Argentina's really pulling, trying to attract people to come to Argentina to develop this land. Now, what's going on in Argentina that's causing them to want to kind of revamp things and attract European immigrants? Well, Argentina, like the rest of Latin America, was ruled by the Spanish from roughly 1500 to 1800. Most Latin American countries gained their independence in the early 1800s, but Argentina was a little bit different. It was never a central part of the Spanish Empire because there was never really even much silver that was discovered there, even though the name Argentina comes from the term silver, but that kind of comes later. So you had Mexico and Peru being the two silver hotspots. That's where the Spanish concentrated. And if you think of where we saw Argentina on the map, it's kind of on the periphery. And it stayed on the periphery economically and politically for the Spanish until the late 1700s, when the British started to snoop around in Latin America, and they started to see the possibility of entering Buenos Aires to begin to kind of trade with Latin America illegally because the Spanish did not permit it. And so the Argentines developed some of these relations with the British, who were much more sophisticated economically and, I would say, you know, culturally in a way than the Spanish were at that period of time. And the Argentines became kind of enticed and familiar with some of what the British were doing. But that didn't really carry over into the early 1800s when Argentina gained its independence, but basically for the first half of the 1800s, Argentina remained the same way it was under colonial rule, kind of following a Spanish tradition, not really looking out to the world for new ideas, economically not, you know, focusing on things like globalization or international trade, you know, being a little bit of a backwater the way Spain had been a little bit of a backwater economically towards the end of the colonial period. Well, things start to change in the 1850s. You start to have a group of intellectuals, lawyers, philosophers, artists, politicians, and others who starts to become really influenced by European Enlightenment ideas, kind of reason and knowledge tied to scientific principles. And they start to want to develop Argentina the way England is being developed, the way the United States is being developed, and the way France is being developed, and Germany to some extent too. Now, why would you want to develop like those places? Because they're the most developed countries in the world in the late 1800s, in the late 19th century. And so they have this blueprint, this vision of what they want to see Argentina be. And at the top of that list is for it to kind of move away from being under Spanish cultural influence and to kind of reshape that cultural influence to have it be more French, American, and British. So their whole focus is on the North Atlantic and the United States, but not places like Kentucky. They're interested in Boston, New York City, Chicago. That's their vision of New York. So they would consider, you know, Kentucky doesn't even enter their mind. This is kind of, you know, within American studies where you'll have the flyover image, right, where it's kind of New York to LA and everything in between is a wasteland. Well, unfortunately, we would be in their wasteland if they even knew anything about this region and they weren't yet drinking bourbon heavily. So in addition to kind of wanting to untangle the Spanish legacy, they also want to develop this landscape. And this is a picture of kind of the Pampas approaching the Andes. And it's an incredibly, this one doesn't quite give you the full feel, but an incredibly rich, fertile grassland area. And for these leading statesmen in the 1850s, they looked at this and saw great potential for Argentina to kind of use this land in a more effective way by tying it into a global economy that we'll look at soon. Yet when they looked at the lands, they kind of saw almost peasant types who are not sophisticated, who lack the knowledge, the education, the know-how to be able to harness this land economically. So that's kind of the second big thing they want to do, is figure out how can we make this land really rich and productive to make Argentina kind of have a voice on the economic stage. And thirdly, they ultimately decide that not only is it the land that needs to be redeveloped, but it's the people on the lands that need to be changed. And so these kind of Argentine statesmen of the 1850s do have some very progressive ideas. They look at democracy with great admiration. They look at the Ben Franklins and others as kind of models of things they would like to emulate and follow. But they also have certain kind of racist or paternalistic tendencies, and that is to view the people of mixed races in their country as not being capable enough to help transform the Pampas and lead them to the place that they wanted to go to. And I think nothing might sum up that vision more than this quotation. I'll read it out loud because I'm not sure the extent to which you can see it. Even if one makes the gaucho, or put differently, the cholo, or put differently, the fundamental share of our popular masses, go through the transformation of the best education system, not even in 100 years will you get an English worker. This was a quote by Juan Alberdi, who was the leading statesman of his time, along with Domingo Sarmiento, and he basically helped craft the modern Argentine Constitution of 1853. So not only do they look at the people on the land and say these people kind of are uneducated and unsophisticated and so on, but fundamentally they say, you know what, they can't even be educated. So here you kind of begin to see those paternalistic or racist attitudes at play at the same time as they're kind of putting forth these very progressive ideas. So we'll look at kind of how they went about attracting these Europeans in order to remake the landscape in both the countryside, that is the Pampas, and also the cities. But before doing that, I thought it would just be cool to look a little bit at some pictures of Buenos Aires through the early parts of the 1900s to get a feel for the vision that they were trying to create in this city. And Buenos Aires was a city that had a relatively small population in 1850, and we'll look at some numbers later on. So Buenos Aires is often colloquially referred to as the Paris of South America. And as you will see in these pictures, the architecture, the use of public space, the wideness of avenues, the dress, the fashions, the theaters, all these things are emulating things from Paris, but not only things from Paris. Really, we can extend this Paris of South America to the London of South America, or if you will, in a way, the New York of South America, though São Paulo would probably have something to say about that today. This efforts to create wide spaces, move away from the Spanish model of narrow streets, cobblestone streets, kind of do away with that architecture, and as the French and others were doing in the 1800s, create these structures that are kind of emblematic or symbols of national pride, and this obelisk or obelisco sits in Buenos Aires today in the heart of the busiest avenue of the city. And that avenue itself, which I don't have a picture of right here, but that avenue named Nueve de Julio for their Independence Day is the widest avenue in Argentina, and indeed until very recently the widest avenue in the entire world. You can't go from one side to the other in one crossing. It'll take you, you would have to run. Here again, the structures that have been created architecturally, the use of public space, the buses, a main kind of bus and ultimately train station area in the heart of Buenos Aires. A rendering, this isn't exactly what it looks like, particularly if you went today, this is almost nicer than what it looks like today, of the White House, or what they call the Pink House, the main Argentine government building in Buenos Aires. And you can see the promenade, the steps, and not only the architecture, but if you take a look kind of at the people, you can see the dress emulating North Atlantic and kind of Northeastern styles. The Supreme Court today in Buenos Aires, very much of that same European style. And you can kind of just wherever you go in particularly certain sections of Buenos Aires, you will see building after building. These are just some pictures of ones that I thought were particularly nice. And then maybe the Pièce de Résistance, the Teatro Colón, the Colón Theater. And this was built in 1908 on this location. It had been built in the 1800s in another location in Buenos Aires. And this is kind of the epitome of Belle Époque or High French culture that really took off in Buenos Aires in the late 1800s into the 1900s. And not only would they build the structure to look like this, but things on the inside, for instance, the curtain. The curtain, this kind of velvet, beautiful, burgundy-esque curtain that you would think of if you think of a British or a French stage, they brought the curtain from England to Buenos Aires at this period of time. It only weighed 2 tons, but they decided that would be a good idea. And this is a spectacular theater. This is kind of a split picture, so you got the chandelier and then these balconies. If you ever are in Buenos Aires, it's a must to go visit the Teatro Colón. And they do sometimes have free shows for the students in the audience, so you can go there. A lot of the shows are expensive, but there's always a free show or two every month. And when we were there this past summer, we went to a spectacular kind of jazz tango thing that was totally free. Culturally, the cafes, you can see kind of the dress of the men and the women in the bottom left. The advent of theaters, Avenida Corrientes in Buenos Aires, a major street with tons of different theaters. And this is kind of for the modern woman over here, you know, appealing to this new style of woman. You can see the architecture on the top left, very typical, not only of Buenos Aires then, but of Buenos Aires today. And then things like subways. Buenos Aires was the first city in Latin America to have a subway. It built quite a long time ago, and it has added to the subway since. The lines kind of going, these two lines are the oldest, they added those, and this one is actually just recently being built, and you can see the dot, 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 it's going to, it should be finished to that dot, dot, dot within a few years. So that kind of gives you a little bit of a feel for what they wanted to create in the city. And in order for them to create what you saw there in the city of Buenos Aires, they came to view Buenos Aires as Argentina's door to the world. And they needed something majestic at that door, the city of Buenos Aires. But in order for Buenos Aires to grow like that economically and develop like that in terms of architecture and landscape and so on, they needed Argentina to become a economic power, and the engine of that growth was going to be the Pampas, or the Argentine grasslands. The Pampas is like the prairies. It's the breadbasket of Argentina. And these are miles and miles of flat plains with very, very lush grasslands. Some people call them the most fertile lands in the entire world. And so the steps to them achieving the vision that we saw and kind of bringing the Pampas into being connected to Buenos Aires so they can export things from the Pampas through Buenos Aires to the world was going to be these various steps. One, recruit European immigrants. If we want to become European, if we want to have Buenos Aires look like the pictures that we just saw, we need to bring the people from Europe here. What better way to emulate Europe, emulate France and England, than to bring the people from there? Two, they needed to kind of harness or tie their economy in to the global economy. And by that, the Argentine ranchers who owned lots of the land on the Pampas saw a very evident economic reality in the 1800s. What was that economic reality, globally speaking? How could Argentina fit themselves into the global economy in the 1800s, second half or so? Say again. Beef and wheat and other things kind of related to beef and wheat, and where would they sell this to? Why is there suddenly a demand for beef and wheat? To who? Europe particularly? England, Industrial Revolution. So in England, you've got this kind of major economic shift going on where all, you know, workers from the countryside are being pushed into the cities increasingly to work in these factories. They realize in England that it's much more productive for them to have their workers doing industrial work than agricultural work. And the English come to see, much like the Argentines come to see, you know what, we can get our agricultural foodstuffs from other countries and use our own population to continue to industrialize because that's more value to England. And for Argentina, this was great value too. So Argentina saw the connection between how Argentina can tie into places like England and provide Europe the food that it itself, particularly Northern Europe, was not producing. Now, in order to bring in immigrants to kind of work the Pampas and to develop them economically, as I just described, they had to take care of one thing, and I put take care of in big quotation marks, and that was the people who were living on the pampas, largely, in the 1800s. Much like the United States, Argentina went through a conquest, which is never a good word, an annihilation might be a better word, of the indigenous populations on the pampas, and that's largely the Mapuche and the Tehuelche Indians. And during these years, 1878 to 1885, there were these military campaigns to basically push the natives out of those lands to less desirable lands in the southern part of Argentina and or kill them in order to create or gain control of this new frontier, this new land. And this is an element of Argentine history that is not spoken about nearly enough. It's certainly something that is well known, but it's not talked about to the extent that it should be in textbooks and so on. And in some ways, I guess if you look at our own textbooks in high schools and so on, we don't talk about our own past that way as well. Now, once they gained control of these lands through the conquest of the desert, and they started to bring these immigrants in to work these lands, and started to realize that they can export these beefs and so on, they needed ways to get those food things, like beef, wheat, sheep, what do you call it? Yes, wool, thank you. Yeah. Complicated word. To the cities, and railroads would be the way to do that. So during the period of kind of 1870s to 1920s, and there you can see the stamp highlighting the 100 years of the Argentine railroad system on the right, kind of 1857 to 1957, but the years I describe would be more intense years. Argentina builds like 20,000 miles of railroad, an enormous amount. Most of this is being built by the British, because the British are the ones investing the capital. Why? Because they want the stuff to get to England so they can continue doing what they're doing. So this is kind of an illustration of an economy, almost like a symbiotic or complementary economy, where it's benefiting both Argentina, England, and other countries as well. And then the other thing that they needed, obviously, is to, once they got the stuff by rail from the Pampas to Buenos Aires for export, they needed a port where the ships could dock and then set sail for Buenos Aires. This is a picture of what becomes known as Puerto Madero in 1925, and you can kind of see, you know, the canal here. They would build these warehouses that would hold a lot of this stuff along both sides of that water bank until it was exported. And a lot of the ships that were used from this were actually assembled in England, brought to Argentina, and reassembled once they got to Buenos Aires. And this whole area was basically, like in Holland, a landfill that was created. So prior to Puerto Madero being built, it was built before 1925, this picture is just from then, but prior to it existing, you know, Buenos Aires basically went to around here. And this building over here is the same one that was on the front, the first slide I showed, that's the customs house. So just some statistics to give you a sense of the scope of immigration, European immigration in Buenos Aires. Roughly about 7.5 million people are going to come during those years. You can see the growth of Buenos Aires. And really, if you incorporate outer Buenos Aires, these numbers are even higher. And how much the population in 20 years roughly doubled from 1895 to 1914. And if you recall at the beginning of the talk, I said, well, the United States has much greater numbers, 32 million versus around 6-7 million to Argentina. In Argentina, in Buenos Aires in 1914, on the kind of eve of World War I, one out of every two people in Buenos Aires was foreign born. And if you include the children of the people who were foreign born, who were born in Argentina, but their parents were born outside of Argentina, three quarters of Buenos Aires was of foreign descent, if you will. You know, immediate foreign descent, not including 300 years of the Spaniards before. Now, where did most of these people come from? Well, the statesmen of the 1850s and then the 1860s and 70s and 80s, they wanted to emulate Paris and London and so on. So their dream was to have Frenchmen and Frenchwomen and Englishmen and Englishwomen come to Argentina, because they would, in essence, transform Argentina into things like France and England. Well, the problem is the economy is not doing too badly in those places. So it is not in too many that come from France and England. There are some pockets that do, But the vast majority of immigrants to Argentina, 85%, come from two places, Italy and Spain. And the Italians who initially come are known as golondrinas, and these golondrinas are basically, the translation for that would be like swallows, birds, migratory birds. And the crazy thing about the early Italians who came to Buenos Aires is they're going to work the Pampa. So they arrive into Buenos Aires and are shipped off to the Pampas to do agricultural work, and they're seasonal laborers. So the early ones in the 1870s and so on are spending half the year in Argentina and then go back to Italy to work the other half of the year. So this was actually like the longest commute in world history. And the other big group that also arrived into Buenos Aires were the Spanish, particularly the Gallegos coming from Galicia in the northwest, but other places in Spain as well. And sorry about that flash element there in the middle. These are great pictures that are publicly displayed in a few areas in Buenos Aires that most people just walk by, unfortunately. It's like in a shopping mall. But I took pictures of the pictures, and that's the flash, so I'll work on that next time. Like to Ellis Island in New York City, Buenos Aires had its Hotel de Inmigrantes. This is the place where the immigrants come, get their name butchered like everybody else, right? Go through quarantine, medical, health, so on, and it's from there they're fed, temporary lodging, and then initially in the 1870s, sent to the Pampas. And when they go to work the Pampas, this is kind of what they go and work. Now, in addition to Italians and Spaniards, as Brian had said at the beginning, I've done some research on some of the Jewish communities in Argentina, and this is one of the names, which is hysterical, of the first Jewish settlement agriculturally in Argentina. It's called Moisesville, or Moises Viche, as they call it. And so these would be the lands that the Italians and the Spaniards and the Jews and others would come work initially. And these people came with very little in their pockets, sometimes just, you know, the children on their back arriving for hard labor. And you know, this would be a good illustration over here of just, you know, somebody arriving, you know. I guess I need to blow that up. I was hoping for a little bit more laughter. I'm like, oh, we'll work on that. And this is kind of a cute little term, but the initial Jews who went to places like Moisesville, they started to write poems, literature, plays, and they colloquially became known as the Yiddish or Jewish gaucho. So gaucho being the quintessential element that we saw early on in that first kind of the uneducated types who lived on the land in the Pampas. So this is a little tongue-in-cheek, but also very sincere. Now, eventually, these immigrants got tired of working on the Pampas. It was not very lucrative, and a big difference between Argentina and the United States is in the U.S., when immigrants arrived, and particularly as they started to move west, they were promised land, right? If you went, or any American, if you moved west to kind of open frontier and developed that land, built a home on it, and worked it agriculturally, that smaller piece of land could become yours. In Argentina, this is really fundamentally a big social and economic problem in their history, is most of the good land on the Pampas went to the generals and officers who had won that war of the desert, the conquest of the desert. So most immigrants can't get real land to kind of call their own. Roughly only about like 10% of Italian, Spaniards, and others who go and work those lands ultimately become landowners. So most of them eventually say in the 1880s, forget it, I'm just gonna go to Buenos Aires. And it's at this time that a lot of those seasonal Italian workers say, not only am I going to go to Buenos Aires, but I'm going to stay there, because things are not going well economically in Italy and Spain in the 1880s, kind of going through a bit of an agricultural famine or recession. Famine's too strong of a word. And there's just kind of plentiful supplies of food, meat, other things in Argentina and Buenos Aires. 1880s, a boom economically in Argentina, kind of part of this boom and bust cycles that they go through. And so Buenos Aires looks like a great place to go. They settle here, and they work in kind of two or three main things. Things related to beef, cattle, in the port areas, related to that wool, that complicated word I couldn't recall before, wool, related to other foodstuffs elements to kind of get them from the railroads to the warehouses and ultimately on the boats. This is what most of the immigrants are doing. Some of them are doing other things like working as house servants and other occupations in the city. Now, the area in which most of them are concentrated on, Buenos Aires I kind of like to think of as like a baseball diamond. So this is the Rio de la Plata. We are looking this would be like west north. Okay, so the area where most of them initially arrive is this red circled area, particularly La Boca, and we're going to look at La Boca in more detail. And then the area around the main plaza in Buenos Aires called Plaza de Mayo or Plaza de Mayo, and that's where most of them are settling when they arrive in Buenos Aires. There are neighborhoods that are a little bit more Italian, a little bit more Spanish, a little bit more Jewish, a little bit more Arab, but there's always mix in all of these neighborhoods. La Boca is the most famous immigrant neighborhood probably in Buenos Aires, and this is the area right by the Riachuelo. The Riachuelo is the mouth of the river, the little mouth of the river. So the Rio de la Plata has a point where the river kind of gets smaller, that's called the Riachuelo, and that's where a lot of the initial factories would set up, initial warehouses and others, in addition to Puerto Madero, where the ships would come in and the railroads would come right up to this area. So this became a central area for tenement houses, as they call them, conventillos in Buenos Aires. And interestingly, a lot of them, particularly in this area, which is very Italian back in the day, La Boca, would be painted these beautiful colors. Now, why would they be painted these beautiful colors? Largely because the ships and the factories that were in that area would, you know, paint their own ships and factories and so on. They'd have extra paint left over. The workers would just take a can of paint on and paint their house, you know, part of it this red, and then there'd be another can of paint, they'd paint it blue, and you eventually ended up with these multicolored structures throughout La Boca in the kind of 1880s, 1890s, into the early parts of the 20th century, and eventually it kind of lost that charm, if you will, faded and stuff like that. Some of them were never painted, and you can see the poverty in some of these multiple family dwellings, very poor sanitation conditions in a lot of these. Outbreaks of some kind of plagues or diseases would happen not uncommonly in the 1870s, 1880s. Eventually, this area is going to be gentrified, if you will, and part of its gentrification in the late part of the 20th century till today is that they reintroduce the colors. So if you go to La Boca today, there are parts of it that would look much more like this one down over here. And the area is called Caminito, it's kind of the way, if you will. And it's like this two or three street area that's got all of its buildings repainted in this glorious multicolored random pattern of old La Boca. And you'll see tango in stores and restaurants and so on. La Boca was such a staunch Italian area. Most of the Italians who came to Argentina came from the northern part of Italy. Most of the Italians who came to the United States came from the southern part of Italy, so that's kind of one additional difference. The ones who came from La Boca, a lot of them were from Genoa and places around Venice. And they ended up not only calling this area La Boca, but it colloquially came to be known as La República, the Republic of Boca, to the point where in 1882, they declared independence from the rest of Buenos Aires. That independence lasted one day. The president, Roca, sent in the military and the police, and they said, no, that's not going to happen. But this area always has had kind of this independence, little spirited flair, and maybe nothing epitomizes it more than its soccer stadium. So this was the soccer stadium that I had the glory of going to see. This is like the Montreal Forum or Yankee Stadium or Fenway Park, better like Wrigley Field or Fenway than a Yankee Stadium. Very, very cozy. The fans in Argentina are nuts. And you have, this represents kind of the working class of Argentina. On the out part, on the murals of the stadium on the outside, you see these murals of kind of working class immigrants. So still today, you get that feel in La Boca. You start to see kind of in the 19-teens, particularly 10s going forward, where there's starting to be some friction in Buenos Aires over all these immigrants arriving. And the elites in particular start to look at all these immigrants and say, they're causing problems. How are they causing problems? Well, one thing is they're not really integrating into Argentine society. Only 2% of all these immigrants in 1914 became an Argentine citizen. 2%, it's really low. In addition, a lot of them maintained kind of these immigrant mutual aid societies, and I put the names of the most prominent ones, Sociedad Española de Socorros Mutuos, basically like a mutual aid society. The Benevolent Society for the Italians, and the AMIA is the acronym for the Jewish ones. So the elites kind of became concerned over that. They became concerned that the children of a lot of these immigrants were going to schools where they were still learning Italian or Old Spanish or, you know, Yiddish or Hebrew or Arabic or what have you, and they felt that that's not Argentine. You know, that's not, does that sound familiar in our country?
Yeah.
And so that kind of started to develop tensions. And then if you think of this period around 1919, end of World War I, this is not only happening in Buenos Aires, but around the world, you know, Berlin, Paris, Eastern Europe, other places, workers are starting to protest more and more. You start to see lots of worker strikes, efforts to unionize in the United States, obviously, too. And in 1919, this massive strike is going to break out in Buenos Aires. It's one of 500 strikes that happened in 1918 and 1919, just to give you an idea of the level of, you know, labor volatility. And a lot of the elites looked at these immigrants and said they're bringing things like anarchism, communism, socialism to Argentina, and that is not what we had intended way back when. So these groups start to form. These are kind of like elite nativist groups, sometimes become very not only anti-immigrant, but kind of openly anti-Semitic and others, not only towards Jews, towards Arabs, but particularly Jews. That's kind of one of the biggest groups they end up focusing on. And they start, you know, putting slogans up on walls that say, like, Jews out and stuff like that. And in 1919, this major strike erupts, largely among Italian workers at a metal plant. And this strike becomes ultimately known as Semana Trágica. In January 1919, Semana Trágica is Tragic Week. This strike is a situation in which the workers go on strike, the employers bring in scab workers, the workers don't appreciate that, they start going at it with the scabs, they start going at it with the police who are trying to protect the employer, and eventually this spills over into just absolute chaos, burning of churches, burning of cable cars, burning of buildings in Buenos Aires, and then groups responding against the workers, killing workers, workers killing police, and the whole thing has to ultimately be put under control by the military. But in the process, not only did you have kind of this massacre of the workers, but these groups over here that would be kind of middle and upper class groups started to try to single out those who they thought was responsible. So this is the area of kind of the Bolshevik or Russian Revolution. So kind of Bolshevik or Russian Revolution equals communism and socialism. That's who they blame. Who would be associated with communists? Maybe Russians. Who are the Russians in Buenos Aires? The Rusos, that's the Spanish term for Russians, which is the colloquial term for Eastern European Jews who came to Buenos Aires. So from this kind of attack of workers, these groups then start heading into the Jewish sections of Buenos Aires and start beating Jewish women, rabbis, cutting beards, destroying stores and stuff. So it becomes kind of this anti-Semitic pogrom in Buenos Aires. That whole Tragic Week is one of the blackest marks on Argentine history. It is something that is very spoken about today over time. So you can see kind of this theater presentation to this pogrom made later on. Now, the pogrom and Semana Trágica had some positive effects, and we will be wrapping up relatively soon here. It did ultimately cause, in the decades to come, Argentine immigrants to look introspectively, as were non-Argentine immigrants, and to figure out what can we do to kind of bring these immigrants into the fold, into the mainstream of society more. So in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, you definitely see, while there's a scar from that Tragic Week, while people look at Argentina differently and feel like maybe it's not the American dream, they also thought of it as an American dream, the way we once thought in the 1880s and 1890s and 1900s, they still look with great pride at Buenos Aires, great love towards Argentina, a land of economic opportunity, and more of these immigrants start to integrate into society. And you could say that was just going to happen, but one of the markers seems to be around the aftermath of that Tragic Week. And they start to move from some of these immigrant areas into areas kind of what we would call towards Midtown or Uptown, as well as these areas which today are the most desirable tourist areas as well as residential neighborhoods. And so you start to see a shift that way. you also start to see things like pizza and pasta, right? The great things we think of when we think of Argentine food, we always think of steaks for a very good reason. The beef there is phenomenal, with the cattle kind of, it's like a whole country of organic agriculture accidentally. You know, all these animals are roaming across the pampas because there's so much pampas, so much grasslands. You know, they're not injecting them and so on and so forth, or to the degree to which we might. But if you go to Argentina, you're a vegetarian, no problem. Pastas, pizzas, and so on. So the Italians obviously brought that with them. And it's at this period in the 30s, 40s, 50s, where you really start to see pastas and pizzas become as mainstream as beef in Argentina. And today, obviously this picture is from 2012, when I was there last year. And this is emblematic of pizza places in Buenos Aires. They're all over the place. They're pizzas you can kind of see laid out on that cutting board, different than like New York pizza or even Chicago pizza. As good, if you ask a person from Buenos Aires, they'll tell you better. But that's, of course, a great debate. The tango. The tango is kind of very emblematic of immigrant culture. And the story of the tango in Argentina is, in some ways, the story of the integration of immigrants into and things of immigrant culture into mainstream Argentine society. Initially, the tango, going back into the 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s, was basically something that would be in brothels and bars in places like La Boca, those immigrant areas that we saw before. It has African roots. There were African slaves that had been brought to Buenos Aires in the 1800s, 1700s as well. And so it was kind of a combination of African sounds and Spanish and Italian sounds. And these merged, but these were viewed as, you know, the worst parts of Buenos Aires culture by the elite in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, but not unlike maybe our society. While some people would criticize it, men from those societies would also be going secretly to La Boca at nighttime to go to those brothels and clubs to listen to it, to be with women, to drink, and so on and so forth. Now, when did the tango transform from kind of that dirty image to what we think of the tango today? Well, in the 20s and 30s, you had some elite Argentine students going to study in places like England and US and in Paris. And this is the period, if you think of kind of the Harlem Renaissance in New York, same type of thing going on in Paris, boom of a music scene. Well, they introduced, these elites kind of in Paris, introduced the tango to the Parisians, even though back home they wouldn't really associate themselves with it publicly. Well, the Parisians come to love it, and if the Parisians love it, well, Argentina loves it, right? And so then these students come back to Argentina and kind of popularize something that they would have previously put down. And it's at this point that the tango becomes embraced in Argentine society, and today it's kind of like the bourbon of Argentina in terms of tours and so on, something that Argentina advertises to the world. Anybody who thinks tango, probably the first country they will think of is Argentina. The songs of the tango are very, very immigrants-based. The name of this one is El Gallego, or the Galician, and I won't translate the whole thing, but speaking of the work involved, arriving, disembarking in Buenos Aires, da-da-da-da-da, and then ending with this kind of optimistic view of sun, of the day, and so on. So this one we will listen to, Giuseppe the Zapatero, Giuseppe the Shoemaker. So kind of, can you get something more immigrant than that, or more Italian in a way than that? And this one, you know, speaks of the happy shoemaker, if you will, and, you know, doing his labor, doing his work, working so hard so his son can become a doctor, kind of the typical immigrant story. And this one is not written by Carlos Gardel, but it's being sung by Carlos Gardel, who was actually born in France and changed his name from Charles Gardès, or Garth, to Carlos Gardel, but he viewed as like the most famous. So, you know, just very typical of the tango. And there's actually been a big revival of the tango, I find, in Buenos Aires over the last 5-10 years. When I was there initially, a lot of the young people would kind of look at the tango like old person's music, not something I want to do. And I see that kind of changing, where now lots of young people are getting back into the tango and tons of clubs where you can go to, you know, like alcohol's not even necessarily involved unless you want it to be. You can just kind of dance endless hours of tango with people who will show you. You can be a beginner and just start dancing with somebody. And this is part of the Argentine scene. One of the professors who came with us to Argentina last year, she's a University of Kentucky professor. She's like a great tango dancer. So she discovered all these tango places, and we'll go back again next year. Dr. Keeling will go, David will go, and you know, hopefully she will join and be able to take you on tango excursions if you're interested. And then kind of last great element of integration of Italians and Spaniards and other immigrants into Argentine society, Juan and Evita Perón, both of kind of Juan of Italian and Spanish descent, Evita Duarte of Spanish descent. So they become president and first lady in the years listed over here. She dies of cancer in 1952, beloved in Argentina, and he becomes kind of the working class president, forever transforms Argentine politics. And there's kind of more story to Argentine immigration in the period after this, but I really wanted to kind of give you a taste of the mass immigration that we saw up until here. And I thought in the remaining slides, we would just kind of look at just some contemporary pictures of how multicultural and cosmopolitan Buenos Aires is because of this immigrant legacy. So you'll just be in like certain neighborhoods, you'll see these like tons of observant Jews, young, old, just walking around, but as Argentine as the next person. I mean, they love Argentina the same way anybody else would, and obviously practice their religion closely. International Jewish Film Festival, the ninth one happening in Buenos Aires. This one, I can't remember the year of this, so they're probably up a little bit. And I particularly like the little yarmulke on there. The German hospital. There's the Italian hospital, the German hospital. Some people will ask me when talking about immigration to Argentina, weren't there a lot of Nazis who came to Argentina? And the answer is maybe not a lot, there were some, but I think it's very important to distinguish when talking about German immigration to Argentina. You had Germans who came in the 19th century, who obviously had nothing to do with Nazis. They, like other immigrant groups, came to Argentina, settled in Buenos Aires and in other places. In the 1940s, when Juan Perón got elected, following kind of the end of World War II, you started to have some Nazis who were granted, you know, hidden asylum, if you will, in Argentina because of sympathies that the military had, but also because a lot of them were very, you know, astute in terms of technology and industry and so on. Argentina was trying to industrialize at that time, so Argentina did view it as them being able to help out Argentina the same way Argentina would obviously help them out in hiding them. And the most famous of these was Adolf Eichmann, who the great Israeli Secret Service man came in, kidnapped him, brought him back to Israel, and said to the Argentines after, "Oh, sorry, we forgot to tell you." You have a very, very large Middle Eastern, and this would have been kind of another component, but just for time, I did not talk about this as much, but kind of Palestinian, Syrian, Lebanese, from different parts even in those countries, coming to Argentina. The Syrians, Lebanese, both Muslim, Christian, and Jewish from those regions, coming in 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, same period that we see this mass immigration. And then you kind of get another wave of Palestinians that come in the 1940s and 50s, following what happened with the establishment of the State of Israel. And kind of culturally within the Arab community, there's a little bit of a looking down on the 1940s, 50s Palestinians by those earlier. That's fading over time, but that does exist. So this is celebrating Heritage Month. This massive mosque, the largest mosque in South America, an Islamic center, was built with this kind of huge grant from the outgoing president of the 1990s, Carlos Menem, who was a child of Syrian Muslim immigrants. He converted to Catholicism because at that time you had to be Catholic to convert, but nobody really believed that he was really converting other than for political reasons. And with a big grant from the King of Saudi Arabia, thus King Fahd, Islamic Cultural Center. These damn British, they just never got a hint. And so even today, you see them sneaking in, trying to stir up some Malvinas or Falkland Islands trouble. the Armenians, a group you wouldn't think of, Armenia. Where is Armenia? Where is it? Right? It's like somewhere between the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, and Turkey in that region. So kind of an Armenian community came to Buenos Aires, particularly following the 1918 massacre, Turkish massacre of Armenians that nobody's even recognized officially today as having happened almost. Our government still refuses to openly proclaim that it happened because we have such close relations with the Turks, and Turkey kind of just refuses to acknowledge it even till this day. The Armenian community, great food, very interesting culture, kind of bringing things from the Russian Soviet area and things from the Middle East together. Museums being built. This is the Museum of the Emigration of Galicians in Argentina, being built in a very kind of up-and-coming neighborhood that was formerly an immigrant neighborhood called San Telmo. And this, again, a tribute to that. A synagogue, Jewish center over here. And one of the things that's really interesting when you look at this, I mean, it's just like any other building in a way, but if you see it's got these barriers on the sidewalk, I don't know how well they translate. You know, these are like these cement barriers that are built in front of these buildings. Anytime you see cement barrier in Buenos Aires, you know it's something Jewish. Why? Well, in 1994, the Jewish community center, that Amia, if you remember back from, was bombed, the whole building destroyed. 85 Jews and non-Jews in the building were killed, and still to this day, it hasn't been resolved. Basically, people presume it was Iran, with kind of some local help, including among the Buenos Aires police from the province. It's an absolute, you know, if you want to look at how not to do forensics work, CSI, you know, courtroom stuff, the head judge who was put on this case was ultimately put in prison for providing $400,000 to one of the key people who was being accused of the crime to get rid of evidence. That's how bad this was. Okay. That happened like 2001. So this is kind of pictures borrowing from the story, which is for another day, of the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo, which happened about 10, 15 years before, showing the pictures of their children. These people, Jewish and non-Jewish, walking through the streets, commemorating this tragedy. So again, to me, this shows integration of these communities, not just something Jewish, but Argentines, non-Jewish Argentines, really came to view this as much as something of their society as the Jews did. And then moving from bad stuff to the good stuff, food. Buenos Aires food is just awesome. And my favorite thing in the world is like gnocchis. And gnocchis are like potato dumplings, you know, if you haven't had them, with Italian style with tomato sauce or pesto or this. And in Argentina, the only place I've ever been to, I don't even think this exists in Italy, but I could be wrong. On the 29th day of every month, it's gnocchi day. And so why is the 25th of gnocchi day? Well, there's kind of like two legends, one legend and one probably more reality, that one of the patron saints of the city of Venice, you know, back in like the 8th century, was canonized on the 29th day of that month. So people, you know, a lot of the immigrants who came to Argentina came from places like Venice, bringing those traditions with them. Probably the more real answer has to do with towards the 29th day, you're getting towards the end of the month, payday's coming, so people have very little left, potatoes are cheap, filling, and so on, so potato gnocchi or potato dumplings were set up. But if you're in Buenos Aires or other places, all across restaurants on the 29th day, they will advertise gnocchi specials. You go to the supermarket, they'll have like cooked gnocchi, you get like a container for like a buck or two, delicious, delicious stuff. I would basically always make sure when I traveled outside of Argentina, when I stayed there for about 2 years, that I always left after the 29th. I would always And here you go, you're in a kind of an area of Argentina, and it says, you know, order here your authentic Italian tiramisu dessert. And, you know, this is in La Boca today, so, you know, very much that flavor. Gelati's ice cream, Argentine ice cream, is Italian ice cream. It's as good as it gets. And, you know, that person over there is just my big love. So thank you, Holly, for allowing me to speak on Valentine's Day. Make it up to you soon. I'm not in the doghouse. And I just wanted to give you one last picture of what Puerto Madero, the old port, looks like today. Totally been gentrified. This is kind of one of Dr. Keeling's specialties. And so these over here are the old warehouses that have now been converted into really upscale office buildings, lawyers' offices, architecture offices, restaurants on the bottom floor, a big tourist thing, and it's a little bit of an oasis from the rest of Buenos Aires, which can be much more chaotic. This area, as you can kind of see, is a little bit more serene, and then these new skyscrapers appearing that are changing the landscape there as well. So with that, an overview picture of Buenos Aires from the plane, a massive city, and thank you, questions, discussion, anything.
We have time for questions, a couple. You didn't say much about the Germans. How did they compare in numbers?
The Germans are, you're looking at roughly in total, in the 19th century, probably around 30,000. And then with the Nazi presence, you know, you're not talking a lot, but you're talking some very high profile Nazis.
Back here.
How's your tango?
Disaster.
You don't even have to dance together.
I held Kai while the tango was going. But I did try, and we had a tango lesson, and I took it.
It's a theme for a lot of Argentine movies, isn't it?
Yes. It is really cool to watch. I mean, you go to La Boca or San Telmo or other areas on Saturday or Sunday, and they will have people out tangoing. And some of them are like not very good, but a lot of them are really, really good. And a lot of schools now send students. This is how they kind of improve and make a little money, throw a hat out or a collection. So it's a beautiful, beautiful dance, obviously very sensual, but it can be danced in lots of ways. And a lot of people associate the tango with being like a very rigid formal dance, which it has, you know, steps that need to be followed, and the man always leads, and it's a very important part. And I saw why that matters when I was being taught, but it also has a lot of room for improvisation. And if you watch people who are good, you'll see them improv within kind of the structure that the tango sets up.
Russ become more famous on the dance contest sometimes.
But it doesn't look at all
tell
like
them,
the,
not at all like that.
The Dancing with the Stars.
One final question, anyone? When you're taking these groups to Argentina, do you spend most of the time in Buenos Aires? Take them out to Buenos Aires?
It depends. 2 years ago, it was 2 weeks with David Keeling in Salta, and then 2 weeks in Buenos Aires. The year before, it was traveling around the whole country. Last year, it was mostly in Buenos Aires with a trip into the interior. This coming summer, we're going to Chile, but the next summer, it'll be 2 weeks in Salta and 2 weeks in wine country in Mendoza. So if you're interested down the road in going to Argentina, summer 2014, the Keys Argentina program.
Wow.
That's my only plug.
Well, now it's that time for the door prize, and we do have a copy of the Farmer's Travel Guide to Buenos Aires, Argentina. Brian, have you got the...
They've got people filling them out.
And I would just say, if you're going to go, the best time are really between, I would say, March through November, December.
The seasons are reversed.
Yeah, their seasons are reversed, and so January, February in Buenos Aires can be really hot. But if you go to other places outside of Buenos Aires, it can be very pleasant. Now, some people like that heat. I personally, it's too humid for me in January, February. But March through December is just gorgeous.
The film Evita, how close to the truth?
You like to tell us how close to the truth do you find Evita? I've only seen clips of Evita. I got a little bored.
Evita is a great enigma. If you haven't read anything about Evita's life, it's really worth reading her autobiography and then reading some scholarly treatment of Evita's life. She was a devil and a saint.
How did you find it compared to the movie? How accurate? The question was, how accurate did you find the movie?
Oh, the movie's crap.
That's
quote unquote.
It's showing on Showtime again this week.
I am fascinated. Now I want to go with you.
You are welcome.
And
this
will never make you wealthy, but it'll be a good thing.
Thank you very much.
Maybe we'll do.
I really, really appreciate it. This is a fabulous series, and it's a great contribution to Bowling Green, so thank you.
We hope you'll join us next. Next Thursday, where we'll be doing a program on Kentucky Live series. The owner of Patty's 1880 Settlement Rest is here. Maybe who knows? And then in March, we'll do a program on the Alpine Expedition. Thanks and happy Valentine's Day.